Hello and welcome back to the Vancouver Business Collective podcast. Today we've got David Longpre, who is an architect and has started his own architecture firm, to come and tell us a little about his business, his journey as an entrepreneur, and a little bit more about the architecture industry as a sector in Vancouver. So, hey, David, welcome and thanks for making the time.
Hey, thanks. Thanks for having me.
So give me the full background intro. Like, how long have you been interested in architecture? Where did you start and how did you get to where you are now?
Well, I'm a stereotypical, ever since I was little, playing with building blocks and stuff. My parents always, buying me Lego and all that stuff. I was always building, little worlds or little castles. I'd get way too much Lego to handle. So I used to build like little cities and everything, ever since I was very young. So that's kind of carried on into, now, but, I didn't know I can get into architecture until I realized you don't need math. So in university, my undergrad, so I was doing a fine arts degree, and then discovered that you don't need any university math to get in, to the master's program of architecture. So that's kind of opened up my door because I hate math. And a lot of people don't know you don't need a university level math to go into architecture because that's what you hire engineers for. Mm. So from there, I just kind of followed where the universe took me, which is basically got into the master's program at U of C after graduating from UBC. And then it's a 3-year internship after that degree. So, yeah, so it's been, I don't know, almost 20 years or more now of just schooling and doing all this. And now finally, kind of life dream was to start my own business and to change the world of architecture the best I can.
Wow, that's a long journey that I can't say I'm thinking about being a realtor for 20 years. Well, thanks for giving me the background on the intro. I'd love to know sort of how you... Because you said you still had you have to do an internship for 3 years.
Yeah.
From kind of where did you do your internship, and how, what's the sort of journey from there to starting your own shop?
So for architects, the industry is having a tough time replacing the old stock. So the baby boomer bell curve as moves slowly towards retirement. There's not a lot of us to replace. So the internship process has actually gotten a lot easier, in the last decade or so, to limit the amount of hours. So it's all an internship is kind of just the name. It's not free labor. Okay. So there's a huge push actually to stop calling it, interns in a way, cause people just think it's free labor. But it's about
what you're doing before you get your stamp, right?
Yeah. Kind of, so yeah, after school, you get your documentation, then you have to start doing your hours. So hours in certain categories, similar to a PEng for engineers. Mm-hmm. But yes, it takes roughly three to four years for people to complete. And in that time, you're expected to hop around from business to business to kind of figure out where your niche is. So mm-hmm. I started off with a startup. Was my first job out of school. So I really got to learn a lot very quickly. I was put with a lot of responsibility very fast because it was just me and the principal. Right. Did that for a year and a bit, but it basically felt like I was a business owner with him because I was given so much responsibility and got to see a lot of the day-to-day building up his brand and that firm. So that I think has always been in the back of my mind. And then as I moved, I got a job offer in Japan. So I couldn't turn it down. So as much as I loved that startup role, Japan's always been a dream of mine. I've always wanted to go over there. If I didn't get into architecture, I was going to go teach English. So I took the opportunity, but Japan is very difficult to live there, especially on your own. It's just it's really intense work environment and you're very much as a foreigner alone. So the loneliness really kind of exacerbated a lot of like my stress levels there. as well as like, you're not getting the salary of a Canadian, you're getting a salary that's like 1950s Japan. So it was all a very stressful experience, but an experience I wouldn't, I would do again, for sure. Japan's taught me a lot, and I've actually carried a lot of their culture and ethos into my own, career. So then when I left Japan, I came back and then worked through a series of different employers, everywhere from huge corporate firms to small firms to medium firms and a design build firm. And I just realizing that nowhere was really fitting for me. There was a lot of the industry is very old and dated in how it views things. So there's very much a passing down the pain. A lot of the older generations don't like that the internship is getting smaller, but so they will punish you in other ways. It's kind of, they suffered, so you need to suffer kind of attitude. And it's kind of in a lot of professions. But I realized that I don't agree with this for my own mental health, but also I watched a lot of people suffer and start hating architecture when for me, it's a passion. So to see people start burning out, to see people just say that they hate it and leave and go to other places was really disheartening for me. And it's too difficult to change these legacy firms inside. You just get a lot of pushback. You see, you're considered the instigator and the troublemaker for trying to make any change. So if I can't find the change, I thought I'd be the change. So that's what really drove me to go on my own.
Awesome. Well, it's a bold step to step out on your own. What would you say you learned in Japan that you're taking into your firm and in all these, even in this journey you've been on thus far as a whole?
Well, Japan, I've always been seduced by their culture in a way. Not most people, it's either anime or that kind of stuff. But for me, it was definitely their actual culture. So the Shintoism and the Buddhism and having a isolated country for, I think it was like 250 years, isolate itself from the rest of the world, really evolved a culture that is very unique. So when you go there, it's very much a culture shock, but they do things in a way where they've still kind of held on to that feudal past. Well, the rest of the world's kind of already moved on. We just threw it out the window. And it's really interesting to see a hyper-modern society, but still have the attitudes of like feudal medieval Japan, and to see a lot of the interesting cultural dynamics of how that works. Specifically for me, it was that I took into my business now, which is kami, or like having every object has a soul, or the respect that is offered to every human being, every living object, sorry, every object or every living thing. I really liked that idea and really drove my ethos of vessels for the soul for architecture, where the question of like, can architecture help grow the soul or help keep people more well off or have a better well-being? And I really liked that concept of trying to relate, does the house have its own soul while it protects the souls inside? So really interesting stuff that I was like kind of toying with over there. But how it helps me in my career is that Japanese are masters of design, and that's through a lot of pain and suffering in the office. And it's nice to go as a tourist, you go enjoy it, but you can see while working there that it was quite, the reason why it was so perfect and all the details are perfect is because of the long hours that people put into it. But they're very much a masters of inside outside blur. So having the environment come inside and blurring the boundaries between indoor and outdoor is really, really key for Japan and what something the West, and especially North America, we lack. We very much try to divorce ourselves from nature when most of us want to get back to it.
Yeah. That very, what an interesting concept to not only be a steward of nature, but of an object too, and to treat it with respect. I hadn't heard that. So that's, mm-hmm. that's interesting. Yeah, very, very different than Western for sure.
Yeah.
Let me ask you, changing gears a little bit, you know, you talked about working at an array of firms of all different shapes, sizes, and styles. And I'm wondering if the difficult time I want to ask you that you've had about as an entrepreneur is really just trying to find that. Would it be trying to find that niche within what's already there and deciding to go out and create your own? Like, what's the most challenging part you faced on your entrepreneurial journey thus far? And then, like, what's the best part so far?
Well, the hardest part is for sure getting over your own mindsets. So trying to have the confidence to go and do it. There's a voice in my mind telling me all the time that, like, this is ridiculous. Like, why do this? Like, when there is so many established firms in Vancouver. And it's a fool's errand in a way. Like, that voice is always going on in my head all the time. But that's the biggest obstacle to overcome is my own inner saboteur, as like RuPaul would say, or something like that. So overcoming that voice is, I think, the most important aspect of being an entrepreneur. I think we all go through that, especially what's it called? Imposter syndrome. So feeling like you're not qualified to even do what you're doing. I go through that all the time as well. But then you just have to kind of learn to trust yourself that we always do make it through all our challenges. And you just have to trust that any challenges that do come up, you can handle. And I'm a firm believer that the universe does only give us things that we can't handle. And if for some reason it's a blunder or something, that's a lesson you can learn from.
Absolutely. Yeah, there is. There's a lot of us feel the imposter syndrome. And, you know, as someone in sales, I think 99% of the stuff maybe 90% when we go out to conferences as real estate or sales professionals is motivational and trying to get people feeling that confidence.
Yeah.
You know, I know some business coaches and they tell me that the bulk of the time that they're spending on these, you know, very expensive phone calls with clients are really just talking about personal stuff and
yeah,
almost therapy.
A lot of it, I've done a lot of therapy in the last 2 to 3 years. So that's really helped push through a lot of the inner child work of the hardships I've had through my personal life in high school or middle school years. So a lot of us still carry that with us into professional environments as well as your adult life, and a lot of us don't even deal with it. So going to therapy has really helped me to combat that inner saboteur, that voice that keeps telling me to just go do the try and true way of just, you know, working up the ranks in a firm. But if the firm is toxic itself and it's rubbing against your values, then it's not worth staying. And if you can't find a firm that has your values or a job that fits your values at all, then maybe it's time to start your own business to create the thing that's lacking. And to go to your question with the niche, like, my niche is that. So I can't find an employer that suits my values that always seems to grade against them. And that's why, like, I wanted to start my own thing.
So, well, what are your values? It sounds like you're pretty in tune with what those are.
Well, so the key ones, is respect. So a lot of employers from the previous generations, you are just a number in a system and you're just a cog. You're not a human being and you're just there to make them money. And a lot of employers need to get over this because there is a huge shift turning even in this last 2 years where employees are now taking all the power back and it's freaking out the management class. And to even mention the word work-life balance in architecture is usually laughed at. And that's just not acceptable to me anymore because it shows a lack of disrespect to the human beings that are helping you and your firm grow. So respect is usually a really, really, really big one for me. But ones that really help is I'm always curious for knowledge. So architecture is always changing. It's a really rapid field that's new technologies are coming in, new bylaws are coming in, governments are always trying to ruin things or mess things up. So we always have to think on our feet really quickly to figure out the solutions for the client, but also satisfy all the regulatory requirements. So I'd say knowledge as well is a huge one. If you're not a curious person that wants to expand their knowledge and stuff, might not be a good profession, because it is changing. And that's one of the reasons why a lot of legacy firms are starting to fall behind, because they're just kind of stuck in where they are, where technology is now, we're already going to VR. So my previous employer refused to even look at a computer. So, there's this huge disconnect, and you have to be able to want to adapt and want to be challenged and want to learn new things. So it's a huge
development.
Yeah. Those are just two. There's obviously more, but I'd have to pull it up. I don't really know, but respect is a huge one. Communication is really big. So making sure that you're taking the time to communicate with people. Mm-hmm. That's just a few, but everyone should sit down and actually think about what their actual values are. And values are not your identity. It's very much, you have to divorce the two. And what you are is not like who you are. So you have to really let go of all the identity and really think about what you value. And you will find that once you know your values, you can live life a little bit more peacefully. Mm-hmm. Because you don't have any guilt or shame about living to your values, because everyone's values are good. No one really has bad values. If you do that, then I feel like a lot of entrepreneurs could probably work through a lot of their issues a lot more. And that's really helped. So the therapy's really helped for me.
I think that's a big one. I mean, my business really took off once I addressed some of that stuff that just kind of lingered and was disruptive and hanging over my head. And I think probably within a year and a half after that, I'd seen a huge growth in my business. I found myself speaking on stage in front of a huge audience, and I found myself engaged, if not married by that point. So lots can happen once you kind of clear away the stuff that's in the way and holding you back. But yeah. Changing gears a little bit here, I want to come back as well to some of the challenges of your industry that you were talking about, and maybe what the outlook is for the future. But, being a newer firm, being somebody with lots of varied experience, like normally I ask people, what's their ideal client? Who is their ideal client? What kind of building or like structure or project would be like your dream project? Maybe I'll ask both those questions.
So for someone like for me specifically, because I'm so curious, I don't want to specialize, and there is a lot of I see a lot of firms in Vancouver that specialize in just their own little niche, but I'd rather just stay open as much projects as possible, because each project, it's really interesting when you work with different clients, you learn a lot from them. So like when you're working with like a biology company, you have to learn a little biology while you're talking to those clients. And then you learn how they like work through the lab. And then you start learning about like their day-to-day tasks in the lab and stuff like that. And I find that stuff fascinating. And to just pigeonhole myself into doing residential houses, I find would be boring. But in Vancouver specifically, we are very residential focused because of the housing crisis. So it is not lost on me that that's going to be a huge part of my business. But I really love working with clients one-on-one. So my top client is usually the actual people using the space. So I really like working with the end user, because then I can craft a space that actually helps their life and actually gives them a solid foundation to have a good home life or have a good business. So working with end users is really key for me. I don't like working for middlemen. Developers tend to just care about selling a product to a first-time home buyer or first buyer. They don't really care about the second buyer, the third buyer living in that space. They just it's a product to them. And I fundamentally disagree that architecture is a product to be bought and sold and just disposed of. We can't keep disposing of houses like they're an iPod or the next latest iPhone. So we used to live in homes that are generational, where we would pass them down from generation to generation. And those houses, whenever you go into those older houses here in Mount Pleasant, there's something you feel is different. You feel like there's something in the walls, like there's something alive. And I really like that idea of bringing that longevity back to architecture, rather than it's just a disposable thing to be bought and sold for the quickest dollar. And so although I'll work with developers, it has to be the right ones that match my values and actually care about the well-being of the occupants in it, not just the first time, but like the whole lifetime of the building. And for me, I'm really focused on the well-being aspect. So and that sometimes doesn't really align with the developer's business models. But so my main clients are usually going to be the end users. So homeowners, business owners, institutional stakeholders that I can work with to actually craft something that's bespoke to their life and what they actually need. And that will create a more successful design, rather than trying to guess what the current marketplace might want and trying to just appeal to as many buyers as possible is what leads to our cities looking the way they do. And there was just a study posted in last year that a poll done of like 2,000 people said like 92% of people don't like where they live. They don't like the aesthetics of the city. They don't like the appearance of where they live. So that's really striking for across Canada. Like, it seems really strange that 92% of us don't enjoy where we actually live in our urban environment. So I really want to try to change that. And I think that comes from servicing the end user or the actual client who's using that space, because they're the ones that have the passion. They're the ones that have the personality that, and every architecture should be different to match that.
No, I agree. I think there are definitely some builders out there that will build things pretty to hit the market at the right moment and just build a product. Then there are also those that do have a bit of a better name. And as real estate agents, we usually know, like, we can guide people to who those better name builders are, who do more thoughtful floor plans.
Yeah.
It's an important one. And those guys tend to want to, you know, of course you want to please the first person, but there is some value in having those people second and third hand, that where it still sticks around and you can see it. Like, I have a few come into mind from our.
Yeah. Well, it's more like treating it like a place for human beings and rather than a product. And yeah. I think that's what's lacking. It's not, you don't have to necessarily consider like three people buying this house. You hope that the person you built it for doesn't ever move out. And, we don't think that way. We treat real estate as some sort of stock portfolio to hold. And we don't really treat it like something we're supposed to be living in, but you spend 60% to 80% of your life in these houses. And it's not just a stock commodity.
Totally. And it's, I'd be wondered, I'd love to know on that poll you mentioned, just because there's so much of, I want the something better. Like, there's just, you know, for me, I live in a little townhome and I still want to have the house. And I think the people in the house are going to want to have the house in the different neighborhood. There's just that thing in a town that talks, that's always the main topic is.
Yeah. I think that comes from the fact that the spaces aren't working for them. And it might be a status symbol. That's definitely a part of the conversation.
I just want a bigger one.
That part is for sure part of it. But if you have a space that actually meets your needs and actually feels like a home to you, there'll be a much harder, you'll have a harder time wanting to leave it. And I feel like the reason why we do hop around so much is because architecture is so impersonal now. It's not it's not a personalized experience. And during the pandemic, we all went through a solitary lockdown in these places we actually don't really like. And that's why the renovation industry just like took off, because people wanted to make their homes actually feel like a home. Because we, again, this is that worker shift where we used to spend most of our time in the office and we barely got to spend a lot of time at home. But now we have to work from home, and that business model is not going away anytime soon. Like, a lot of us will be working from home still. So I think it's time for the market to be disrupted so that places, people can actually enjoy being at home rather than feeling it like it's a prison.
Yeah, when you're in it as deep as I am in yourself, like I have a heart, and I listen to all the housing podcasts about fixing all these things. And part of me goes, I have a hard time seeing it, because there's just so much systems in place that I just kind of, I don't know, when you're deep in the system, it's hard to think of it as changing. Let's leave that tiger in the cage for now, because that could be a much longer conversation, and switch it up and talk a bit more about maybe some specific challenges of the industry for you that you want to maybe just like pick one. I'd be curious to know how architects get along with each other, because there's a lot of ego involved in that. And I've got a garbage truck going down my lane.
No worries.
And then what about the outlook for your industry? And then we'll wrap it up.
You are correct that there is a lot of ego in the industry. And what's really helped me is detaching that ego. And the industry can't keep going on with that arrogance prevailing in the industry as if we know everything, because we're expected to know so much now. Like, as I said, everything's changing. There's so much new technology. The biggest challenge of our generation is obviously going to be the environmental push to try and make as many homes environmentally friendly as possible, either through being a carbon neutral house or a passive house. But with these, while still considering that people are living inside them, and people really love windows, and a lot of the measures are trying to reduce the amount of energy loss. And that usually means eliminating windows or eliminating air circulation and stuff like that. So I'm always concerned about making sure that our buildings are actually there to help our well-being and to make sure that we're still healthy in these spaces while helping the environment. But the environment's the biggest push. In our industry is the biggest trend. And I think that's across all industries, but as well as we need to start, there's a huge, in that same poll, actually, they were saying that clients don't feel listened to. So they feel like developers make all these decisions and then they don't really get listened to. And it's developers who make our city, and people don't get a say. And that's quite often the case in a lot of developments, where as an architect, we're supposed to be leaders. We're supposed to be the ones advocating for the people, the public. But in the end, we kind of get bullied by our bigger clients like that. So I really think architects need to be more of a leadership rather than a follower, and just following trends. Like, we actually need to start leading the profession again and start being more bold with how we interact, not only with clients but also with the architecture itself, to bring maybe some more visual interest back to communities, but also engaging with communities to see what actually people want. But I think it was like 80% of people feel like they're not listened to when it comes to dealing with a construction or architecture, and that does again come back from that ego. It's architects think we know everything, or like we're gods ruling over the built environment, but we're really not. I mean, you don't really know everything, and it's important to listen to other people and see what people actually want. And I think that comes back again to the space is not working for people because you're not listening. And I really enjoy that one-on-one sit down with clients and actually listen to what they want and work out a checklist of everything they want in the space. But it's also my job to find out what they're not telling me. or what they can articulate. And that's a different kind of listening that is a skill that a lot of architects need to develop or need to keep coming back to keep training that and not just think that you, I've done it before, so like whatever, I don't need to really listen to you. And with, as well with bylaws and code, it's changing all the time. And a lot of architects are retiring because they're just sick of it. They're sick of how much the government is getting in to every single little nitty gritty detail of a building. And I think that is a huge problem because usually when government tries to help, it sometimes doesn't help. So like just having the bureaucracy doesn't really do anything. But sure. A lot of retired architects kind of laugh and say like, good luck to me, because they just see that there's too much, just too much obstacles to construction. There's too many check boxes to do. So a lot of my job as well is to be the liaison with the government and to make sure that these structures and stuff get built to their requirements. And that could be another reason why clients or citizens don't feel like they're not being listened to, because there's so many people involved that are trying to shape the house for what they need to be. Personally, I think if it's your house, you should do whatever you want, but cities don't agree.
No.
Yeah, there's a lot of cooks in the kitchen when it comes to putting a house together.
Yeah.
And from the person who's sitting there putting together the drawings for it, I can see how having that many voices can be a real challenging orchestra to conduct.
Yeah,
I told you before.
It is like an orchestra in my mind while I'm designing. Yeah. So like there's a lot of voices while I'm drawing the wall. People don't really realize that we're not just drawing willy-nilly. Like there's a lot of voices going on in your head of like code, bylaw, and like just to make a certain room a certain size is dictated usually by some sort of experience, like Triad Trude Way, or it's a bylaw requirement. So it's not just pretty pictures and drawing. So a lot of people have a misconception that architects, they don't really know what we do. And I think that's another big hurdle that we need to get through. And that comes with educating the client. So spending more time educating people is a huge thing to help people feel more listened to. Because if they actually understand why I'm doing things, then they will feel like they're more involved and they actually understand what's going on. And a lot of clients don't understand what's going on. They honestly they feel a lot of stress during architecture. Because there's just so much that they don't know, and there's so much I don't know, and that's why you have that whole team to kind of work together to build something. So I can go on for like quite a bit.
I'm sure. You know what? I can't wait to do one of these with a contractor, a general contractor, or a carpenter, and then maybe have like a discussion between the two of you, because that was my favorite conversation with the architect, was to watch the carpenter that I brought to an event speak to a guy who was the technologist, architectural technologist, on the same building. And the earful that she gave this architect and the carpenter gave the technologist was because that's a voice that, you know, maybe has all the on-the-ground feedback for you as the architect. But anyhow.
Yeah, if you don't have a good relationship with the contractor, especially as an architect, like it's not going to go well. Like, and that's huge as architects. They really need to get over the fact that like the contractor is actually more knowledgeable about construction than you. And that
you said you slept over at a site, or you were like camped out there once because you had to be so hands-on, right?
So you do get bad contractors because they're not a regulated profession. Like they're not regulated. Anyone could be a contractor.
Yeah.
So you are going to get bad apples and you are going to get really good dedicated ones. But it really does take, you have to give every inch of like communication or an opportunity for them to solve the problem. And you have to work with the team, and it can't be, you know, like just screw them. Like not you represent the client, and it's in your best interest to get along with the contractor to get the project done. And I find working with the contractor, they teach me a lot. So I love going to trades. I love them telling me how things should be put together because they're the ones doing it. I'm just the one drawing it on a computer. So it's really nice talking to people in the field because real life is always different from what you conceive on a computer screen. Yeah, so like having those relationships is really important.
One guy told us at an event recently how like he couldn't put the window in. There was nowhere to, for this. I don't know how many ton piece of glass or weight, but and the like it was like you're supposed to hold this with your finger and then drill it into the building. So I like you say that's an important piece. Listen, David, what have we not touched on that you want to leave people with before we wrap this up? And after that, let everyone know how to get a hold of you. What's the best place to find you?
I think we covered a good swath of it. I'm really interested as well as bringing a lot of soul back and spirituality back into spaces as well. So that's something we can talk another time about. But you can check out my website, lawnprairiearchitecture.ca. Or you can get a hold of me through the contact information on there. I'm looking to help as many people as I can to get spaces that actually work and give them a strong foundation for their lives. So thank you so much for having me on here.
Thank you. And another great place to find David is always at our monthly Vancouver Business Collective events. Not sure when we're publishing this. Today we are recording on September 1st, 2022. It'll be up in a number of weeks from now, I'm sure, but we hold these in the middle of the month on a Wednesday, somewhere around Vancouver in a really nice venue, great group of people, business owners, entrepreneurs, some business development people. That's who this group is really tailored to and designed for. And so you can find out more about that by contacting me, Josh Kepke, at 604-313-9805. Or you can find that on my Instagram page at Josh Kepke, and a number of other places. It's Eventbrite is where we generally post the event. So type in Vancouver Business Connections there. And finally, you know, last but definitely not least, you know, if you're not a real estate agent and you're listening to this podcast or watching it, if we published it that way, get in touch with me. I'd love to talk to you about the housing market and where the deals are. What's happening? It's the main topic of conversation in Vancouver. So I'd love to leave you with some great points and things to share with your friends, family, colleagues, and even just give you some advice if you're looking to buy or sell residential in the Lower Mainland. So thanks. That's it for now. And we'll see you next time.